This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together. Hello, universe. Welcome back. It is your boy with another episode of A Lost Plot. I am your host, as always, Maverick, back again with two of our favorite guests. Today, we've got both Avalon and Patrick. Avalon, thanks for coming.
Hello, hola, konnichiwa, and leho.
And, of course, our man, Pat. Patrick.
Hello. I'm back for a non-horror movie or horror-related thing.
And it's not Dungeons & Dragons, so...
And it's not Dungeons & Dragons.
What is he doing here?
I'm out of my element. Or am I?
That's right. We are... No, he's actually quite in his element. But before we get to that, we just want to give that thank you to our listeners out there who review the podcast. As we always say, the reviews are big for the podcast world, so we appreciate it when you guys give us a little love and give us those stars and leave a review. Today, we got a review from one named Train Tracks, quite a good one. And they said, Maverick and his guests dissect the plots of various movies, usually based on a theme of the episode, and evaluate them based on storytelling aspects. For a plot enthusiast who love to analyze and perhaps overanalyze the structure and meaning of movies. So thanks, Train Tracks, for leaving us a little love at... Pretty much sums up where we're at. We don't mind going a little in-depth on some of these. So yeah, definitely the overanalyzed part is right up our alley. If you like that, keep listening because that's what you're going to get today. We are reviewing What Makes a Compelling Villain. So this is one of our Movies Worth Watching series going in-depth on the concepts rather than a specific plot line. So, Avalon, when it comes to making a villain compelling, what do you think the core elements of that is or are?
All right, just to start things off a little bit, I just want to clarify, we're talking about flesh and blood antagonists to the protagonist in whatever story we're talking about. So I'm not going to talk about, like, this is going to exclude, like, nature forces, like, say, cyclones or disasters. This is going to exclude, like, most of the horror monsters like Godzilla and such. So, and those can be compelling villains and they have their places. But for today's discussion, like what makes a compelling rounded villain character type, we're just going to stick with the antagonists of most of the movies you're familiar with. So,
yeah, for those other types, we do touch on them briefly in our 10 types of conflicts Movies Worth Watching episodes. So if you want to get more in depth on that, go ahead and give that a review. Avalon, keep going.
So, I mean, there are several things. I mean, I took a hard look, and wrote down a bunch of compelling villains just, like, from across the board of several genres and just, like, asked what is similar about all of these guys. And I could talk about them. I could talk about my list if you want.
I think the broad brush strokes is what we're most looking for, and then we delve down into the examples. But okay, if you think listing them is more helpful, you can go that route.
Okay. Well, I'll list them. I'll list the broad brush strokes I came up with, and then we can discuss them. So, I would say for a compelling villain, like, you need someone who has the power and the means of destroying, hurting, or foiling the protagonist. If they can't do that in some regard, you don't have a compelling villain. They need to have some level of ability to, like, stop our hero, stop the main guy, whoever it is. Like, if they can't do that, then they failed as a villain. I think that's the first point that's important. The second thing I would say is that villains have to have their own desires, their own motives. They can't just be static, like, oh, I'm against the hero. Like, if we want a compelling, truly fully fleshed villain, they have desires, they have motives, and we can see that played out. And also even though they have the power to destroy the hero, or they have their own motives and desires, they also have weaknesses as well. Like, generally, like, they're not, like, oh, like the unstoppable force of nature. They're not like, all powerful. Like, they have some weakness somewhere. They have some, like, flaw or something that can undermine their ability, or, like, can, is it like some weak point that other people can get at them by, more or less. And it's usually how the hero wins in some regards sometimes, but, and then I put as a question mark, this isn't necessarily a mark of a good villain, but some of the best villains instill in us a sense of dread when we're watching the movie. Like, they give us this idea, like, you kind of get this, like, almost that uneasy, like, feeling of fear, but also, like, expectancy, where it's like, you know they're going to do something bad. You know they're going to somehow, like, stop the hero. They're going to, like, stop what we want to see happen, but you just don't know how. And then when they do it, it's like, it gives that sense of fear, that dread, like, oh, what, now what?
Cool.
So those are the basic ones I have. I mean, we could discuss these things a little bit deeper if we want. So
yeah. So let's go with the first one, which you said was the, basically they have to be in direct conflict with the villain.
We could just say villain and hero. That's easier.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The only thing that struck me when you first said this is like, some people would be like, oh, that's obvious, but I'm sure there's examples out there of times where the person who was supposed to be a villain or at least a side villain actually couldn't really do anything. And maybe that's more of a comedic bit, but I wasn't sure if you guys had examples that came to your mind when you thought of that.
I mean, I didn't exactly have I think sometimes we confuse weak villains with like a power over the hero kind of thing. Like, I mean, unable to stop the hero kind of thing. Because I thought of one villain that came to mind was Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life. Like, he's an invalid in a wheelchair. So by most society's definition, he's weak and powerless. But he's also a wealthy man and controls a lot of influence in the town against George Bailey. So it's like, what makes him a compelling villain in some regards is that he has power over George Bailey. And like, he's directly opposed to George Bailey because he wants to profit off the people. He wants to he wants to control the finances of the town more or less. And George Bailey stands opposed to him in that regard. So it's like, so he makes this very compelling villain where it's like, you know, he's an invalid. He's very powerful. Like he has, like, he gives you that little sense of dread. Like he's not a weak guy. He's kind of despicable.
Right. And it's specifically because he's a villain that's made, to work in the banking industry, and George Bailey himself is working in the banking industry, and they have very different goals with working in that industry. One's to help people and the other is to make as much money as possible. And so even though you're right, he is in a physical sense a very weak character, everything about how he's built as a person is completely opposed to how the protagonist is built. So that's an excellent example.
I was thinking of Mr. Glass from Unbreakable.
Okay, yeah.
Who is also one of those sorts of people that we'd look at it as like so physically weak, he's not a harm. But I mean, that's also a special example, I think. And I do want to like discuss the very special examples to each of these sorts of things because I wrote down what you were saying as you were saying it. And I'm compiling a list of people from all the different things that I know to kind of show a subversion of the status quo regarding like how we view power over the hero or power over the situation in general. So I thought of Mr. Glass because he's unassuming of being a villain. He's very weak. He's called Mr. Glass because his bones are very fragile like glass. He's got brittle bone disease, I think is what it was, but it's not spoiler alert if you haven't seen Unbreakable from whenever that came out, I forget now. But Mr. Glass sort of like kicked off the movie by being the source of a bunch of these different horrible accidents in search of somebody who is the opposite of him, somebody who is unbreakable. And he shows his true colors like pretty much at the end of the movie, and that never gets addressed for many, many years up until, what was it, Split came out and then Mr. Glass came out. And I didn't ever see Mr. Glass or whatever it was called. Glass, I think is what it was just called.
I haven't either.
At least my perspective of him based on just Unbreakable and Split is exactly this. He's set up to be a very smart, cunning, devious person that has this power over the hero. That is,
well, he's very unassuming too.
Very unassuming, and that's part of his power.
Like the whole movie, you don't even realize he is the villain until the very end. Where it's like it's this whole shock twist with like, oh, he is the mastermind behind all of this. Like he's actually just, you think he's just like almost like a mentor figure, where it's like he comes to him and Glass seems to have all the answers and he's like explaining things in a way that makes sense. So it's kind of a shock when he's not the mentor.
Through it all, like the twist is only that his intentions were bad, really. And then you're like, oh, now he equal bad. The other example that came to mind isn't from movies per se, but it's from the Borderlands series. Handsome Jack as sort of our standard protagonist, who I find him to be a very compelling, or not protagonist,
antagonist,
villain,
yeah.
antagonist. Yeah. I'm going to be mixing those up all because I like only woke up about a half hour ago.
Good morning.
He's like your standard antagonist, your standard villain, but I find him very compelling because in the game format, you're able to explore all of these things about him significantly more so if you put the time into it. And he continually, expresses and shows that he has a power over the situation and over the player, over the heroes of the game. And then in the same game, in a DLC, we get literally the opposite, which was a reference to something you said, Maverick, where in one of the DLCs, there's this dude named Professor Nakayama. He's in the Hammerlock DLC. And he's hyped up to be this big pain in the butt boss fight where he has like turned all the locals of this area against you, and it's real pain in the butt. It's a very difficult DLC. And once it becomes real that the hero is going to go and fight him, he gets cold feet over the radio and he starts like trying to talk you out of it now, even though he wanted to fight you in the first place, and that's kind of what he felt like he should be doing. And then at the end, if you haven't played the game, the boss fight starts there's always usually a cutscene in the more serious boss fights, and it's him at the top of the stairs being very anxiously trying to come up with a villain monologue, and then he trips and falls down the stairs and dies.
That's funny.
And that's what happens. It's like, oh, well, they subvert the plot itself, subverted the villain's power for the sake of the comedy of it.
Right.
I still
right,
consider
yeah.
him a villain. Compelling, not as much. But then because they did that, I'm like, I love that. That's so funny.
Yeah.
In a comedic sense, it works very well.
Yeah,
but as far as a great villain goes.
And that's it knew that. Mm-hmm, they were aware of that because you could see how they designed the other villains. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, you know what? All care to the wind with this one. Let's have fun with it. And then they made it something silly. And I love that.
Well, let's probably move on to the second bit of the four categories that Avalon outlined. What do you think in regards to, and can you restate the second one for our audience?
We're talking about how villains have their own motives, desires, or are we talking about something else?
That was the second one.
Yeah.
That was the second. Okay.
I wrote them out as you said it.
Sorry, I did not write them out, so I'm kind of relying on you guys to restate them. My bad. Yeah.
You're more experienced than this man.
Yeah. I mean, another thing I feel like, another thing I don't know if I've ever said is that just because someone is the villain doesn't mean they are an evil character per se.
Yeah.
They could just be mean. Doesn't mean they're evil. I think of, like, for example, Warden Norton from Shawshank Redemption isn't necessarily an evil character. In fact, he's kind of like this righteous character in some regards, but he's also very strict, and he's very much like, again, like he is also corrupt in some regards, where it's like he's clearly taking money from the, like taking advantage of this prison and the cellmates to bolster his pockets.
Well, yeah, and honestly, I was thinking of a similar thing too it's a book, it's not a movie, but it's Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment.
Yeah.
The main officer, Petrovich, is the antagonist to the main character, Raskolnikov. But Raskolnikov is trying to escape the law, and Petrovich, the officer, actually represents the law, and he's a good man trying to do a good thing, which is catch the protagonist for what he did that was wrong. And so it is a little bit of a whole reversal in that way too, but in that case, the antagonist is actually a good man trying to do a good thing.
That's kind of the issue we run into when we come to define, like, with standard terminology, what a villain is, because most generally speaking, the villain's the air quotes bad guy.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why I like to use the term antagonist and protagonist, because it holds less to the standard, like, morale kind of gauge that we use for the term villain and hero, which is why we have like compelling things like anti-hero movies.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. Because by technicalities, we flip the whole thing on its head. And I'm just trying to think of a good one that comes to my mind, because I don't want to go with basic ones because I don't do that. Or do I?
Well, I was just going to reach for a basic one. Venom is the perfect anti-hero, in my opinion, because he can swing both ways, that he's used as a villain for Spider-Man, but then he also has been used with the Tom Hardy movies as a compelling character in his own right, who has motivations to do the right thing in certain circumstances. I don't know that, and honestly, sometimes anti-heroes, I find more compelling than some mm-hmm. heroes in stories, simply because it's very apparent that anti-heroes have flaws, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit of a detour, but yep. they very clearly have an opportunity for growth that they can then grow through and become a better person, which is a great opportunity for an awesome character arc. And mm-hmm. sometimes there's a flaw that I think good stories tend against, but it can happen where the heroes are already so good that they don't really have a lot to go through to become a better person. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that's not realistic because all of us are incredibly flawed. All of us have opportunities to grow. And so to not represent the main character like that is to represent them unrealistically. Mm-hmm. It makes it a little unbelievable.
I think it's very important to look at this quite frankly, which is interesting because I think a good example, and it does kind of fall into generic, but I'm not going to reference the standard interpretation of it, but Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Both the film from 1994 and the book are like I believe the one by Kenneth Branagh is the most accurate depiction of the actual book. Mm-hmm. But that has a very flawed protagonist and a very compelling antagonist, in my opinion, because yeah. we literally see the creation of the antagonist, and the antagonist is in many ways, I'd say, able to address a lot of these different aspects to the idealized villain that that Avalon brought together. But just to get it started, because I'll keep referencing back to it, has power over the hero / protagonist and has power over the situation. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the monster, which is only referred to as the monster in the book.
Yes.
has not only just like immense amounts of strength, but also so much rage that it will do nothing, or it will have nothing stop it before it can get what it wants done, before it can enact its revenge. And it makes it very frightening to address that optional thing later. But also his desires are essentially that you created me and you didn't want me and blah, blah, blah. We can go over all the different details.
Yeah. What makes the monster so compelling when you read the book anyway is like he's a very full-fledged character where it's like he's created out of nothing. He's like a child. Yeah.
He's like a child and he talks and he's vengeful and he makes good points. He makes very good points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really love the monster as a good example of a compelling villain.
Yeah. I mean, and if you look at the monster's base desire, he doesn't want to be alone. He wants to be loved.
Yes.
That's a very good desire to have. And it's like, so humanity shuns him. They cast him aside. And so then he goes to his master, like the person who created him, and because he's already rejected him, and he's like, make me a mate. Make me someone who can live with me and love me as I am. And it's just like, it's such a compelling motive and an understandable motive for us as the audience.
Yep.
It doesn't justify his actions, but it does. No. But it's completely from a human perspective.
For those of you that think it justifies his actions, I wouldn't know how to address that at first, but give me some more time in a PhD program and I might be able to get you some psychological help.
Jeez. Yeah. Let me just play the devil's advocate here for a minute. So with the idea of a villain having motivation, is that always the case?
No.
Because what about villains such as and I know you kind of outlined that monsters aren't really carried in this category, but they could still be, let's just say, someone who's directly opposed to the antagonist or in some way. Would you just say that those movies are less compelling or are completely...
No, I think, as I said at the beginning, like those movies and stories have their place. Like I just watched, like, for example, you can make a very good movie with a monster. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I know Maverick hasn't seen this, but, and maybe Patrick, I don't know, but I saw Godzilla Minus One recently.
I've heard many good things that I need to watch.
And it is a phenomenal movie, but the Godzilla, like as a character, like he's a monster. He's the villain of the story, clearly. And he's like going on a rampage across Japan in various cities and different areas. But it's just like, as a, so like the story is very compelling because you actually touched on this earlier, but the hero goes through the character, like, he's a flawed character, and he goes through so much character change over the movie, and it's such a story you root for him to change by the end of it.
Yeah.
And it is, like, it is phenomenally well done. But the villain, like, he doesn't have, like, you can't really say Godzilla has a motive, per se. It's just a monster causing destruction. Like, it's not clear
I'd say you should be careful in defining motive as something like complex.
Well, besides animal instinct.
There you go. Yeah. Hunger can be a motive for the movie from, like, I think it's 2010, called Maneater with Gary Busey. And it's like I think it was a lion or something that got loose in, like, Louisiana. Gory movie for young Patrick to watch. But the point was that it was a hungry lion that was out there. It was scared and it was defensive. And that was its motive for the way that it had to survive. And the way it had to survive was to kill what was hunting it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'd say that's technically a motive.
Yeah.
It's basic, but it's still a motive. Just like Godzilla probably has a very basic motive like that.
Right. And I would say that kind of going back to what Avalon was pointing out a little bit earlier, that at the end of the day, the main character we are following is the protagonist, right? The person who we're seeing the mind of. And so when it comes to the trade-off is, are you going to focus on growth for the motivations of the protagonist or the antagonist? Definitely focus on the protagonist. But
yeah,
there can be situations where the antagonist has less complex motives, such as a monster, and it's still motivating.
Well, I mean, even, like, a complex villain can have, like, less clear motives. Like, I would say, like, Darth Vader in Episode 4 doesn't have clear motives, per se. Like, it's like, maybe a serve the Empire kind of thing.
I raise you this. I think, in some cases, a villain can have no perceivable motive, and that make him more of a villain, more frightening, and more compelling. Uh-huh. Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men.
Okay. Well, I mean, even he has a motive per se. Like, for example, he's going through the whole movie, he's following the trail of the money. And it's like, so he has his desire, his goal.
Doesn't even want the money.
No, he doesn't. But his goal is to get to the money.
His goal is just get the money. And that is the most basic. It doesn't even go to he's trying to survive. It's just acquire thing.
Well, so what's so interesting about that villain specifically is just how, and we actually go over this when we go over No Country for Old Men. If you guys want to see our review of that podcast, that one was a lot of fun to talk about. I personally think Anton Chigurh is such a very interesting villain. But one of the things that makes him so interesting is the rules that he has in place for his life. And it's almost, to a certain degree, he's better at following his rules than the everyday moral person is. And that makes him terrifying because his set of rules are completely different from our set of rules. And you don't know exactly, like, it draws into question that such a person could exist, right? Mm-hmm. And it strikes fear in you in a way that other villains just don't. So, I think that the rules following aligned with motive is a great combo. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, in a way, the rules become their motive. But
I was stewing on this.
Power.
I was stewing on this on the drive back from work before I passed out. Chigurh is a very compelling villain, and it's very hard to tell why. Because it's like his motive being he's trying to get the money back is, I wouldn't even say a motive as much as it is his mission.
Mm-hmm.
His motive is his overall drive.
So maybe I didn't clarify the point a little bit. Maybe we should say it's like it's motive, desire, mission, or something like that, where it's like they have perceived thing they're working toward. Like they're not some static character. They have something they're working towards.
Yeah, and I'd say those are each separate things. Mm-hmm. So I could break it down this way. Mm-hmm. If we're saying motive, desire, mission, I added depth to all of these in parentheses. The depth of these is very important to understanding the character. If we have motive, his motive is not his mission. His mission is to get the money back. His motive is to be the agent of fate.
Right. And this kind of goes back to what they're opposing, right? Because there can be villains who are going for the same thing as the hero is.
Yep.
The difference is that they are very immoral, or they have different rules they follow.
The missions are the same, but the motive is what determines who the protagonist and antagonist are.
Right.
Or
so,
just how it started. Because if we watch from Shiger's perspective, can you imagine how horrifying an anti-hero perspective of Shiger would be? His money was stolen and he's just trying to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Very John Wick depth.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's... Don't get me started.
Had to go there. I had to.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I do think that at least to some degree you're going to see motive, right? And so
motive is going to be the drive of the mission.
Yeah,
right. His motive being he's the agent of fate.
Mm-hmm.
That aligns with his rules. That mm-hmm. aligns with his desires. It doesn't equal his mission, but his mission aligns with his motive.
Right. I think another thing to note on this is that you don't always see motive portrayed clearly in the story. It can be indicated through almost side characters even, or other ulterior things that go on. And this comes to mind for me specifically because I just recently was in a discussion with someone else about The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. And what was interesting to me is the character of Sauron, who never speaks a word in any of the three movies that you watch. Mm-hmm. And yet he is the main driving force in these three movies. And for a lot of people, people especially like myself, I consider the series to be incredibly compelling. And so the question is, how is this villain compelling? And I think that a lot of his motive is portrayed in the villains that he has doing his bidding, or specifically in the ring itself. Yeah. Where you have these things that show the neediness of Sauron and his desperation to get the ring, and almost a certain semblance of fear and concern if his will is not carried out. And so he is definitely an overpowering force, but even within that, you get this desperation emanating from all the actions that all of his underlings are doing. So I think the motivation can still be portrayed, but more in subtle ways. And so those might not be clear at first, but they still are carried out, and you can still pick up on them even ever so slightly in the movies.
Yeah. And a lot of it's like the depth you're willing to read something. Like if you're just watching No Country for Old Men as an action movie, Shiger is going to make no sense and is going to have no motive apart from get the money back. But when you watch that movie, if you go in with the whole it's a John Wick type action movie, you'll be sorely disappointed and very upset at the fact that this guy seems like a random mass murderer of some kind. And that's it. No traceable motive. But when you really read into it, just like with Lord of the Rings, just like you have to do with other mediums that use villains, like video games, books, where you literally read into it, there's a lot of depth and scouting that the individual has to do with a film, with an art medium that is portraying a villain, because part of the idea of having all this, the very basis of this question is what makes a villain compelling? We're asking people to analyze a character, but we don't analyze a character based off of purely a set of rules. We analyze them from a perspective of humans with morals, and that analysis determines how we view the person. How we view the villain, whatever the villain may be. And because of that, we put a little bit of our perspective, ourselves, our morals to compare with them. And that requires more depth to it. That requires you to read in between the lines a little bit. The guy from Seven, the serial killer from the movie Seven. Have you guys seen the movie Seven?
I have not.
Then I'm not going to say a thing. Don't you guys worry, but that is your homework.
It honestly is. That's my bad.
I'm ashamed.
How could you even be on this podcast?
So this whole time I'm scrolling through my movies library that I have on my Google account, and I'm like going through. I find Seven. I'm like, cool, compelling villain. Alien, we'll talk about the more animalistic kind. Slither is actually a very interesting one, but I know you guys haven't seen that yet. And I brought that up, I think, in the last podcast, which kind of went on the tangent of Patrick has a weird sense of humor. But then I'm going through, and it's mostly horror movies, because, I mean, if they didn't know at this point, they should know now that I love horror movies. I almost said I'm a horror movie buff, and I almost held that, which wouldn't have sounded right.
Well, I did add one movie villain from the list. This is probably more in your wheelhouse. I don't think Maverick's seen this one. I added Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
From Silence of the Lambs, because I think he's also a very compelling villain, too. And actually, he's an interesting case as far as motives go, because he's not directly opposed to the hero in the movie.
He's not.
In fact, like, he has his own desires. He has his own motives, but he's actually kind of helping the hero. And he's like the psychological, like the psychological games he plays with the main character is so interesting.
Yeah.
But it's just like,
when you deep dive into the series, the film series, Red Dragon, Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal, you kind of get a better scope of his character and like what, and how his motivations work in the first place, what his function is, how he works, and then how that is then placed over him as the template to understand what his actions are. And then when you throw the show into that, the show, which is technically unrelated to the movie series because it's Mads Mikkelsen playing it, my favorite show, I probably say that every podcast. But what it does is it gives you his set of rules as they develop and as he refines his craft before he's captured by the police. And he says this one thing, and I'm pretty sure it's kind of a riff on, like, I think it's Paul, the Apostle Paul, saying, as much as you do live peaceably with all men, or something like that. Hannibal Lecter has a quote that says, in as much as anyone can do, one should always eat the poor, or eat the rude.
Nice.
Without the concept of eating, but his whole thing is he punishes rude people. So in Silence of the Lambs, towards the beginning, when Jodie Foster's character walks in, a very gross thing happens to her from one of the schizophrenics in the psych ward. And what Hannibal does to him after that, if you recall.
I vaguely recall what happened to him,
you don't have to be vague. You could just say it.
So he whispers, he basically like apologizes to the FBI agent and calls her back and then gives her kind of a lead to go off of. And then he says, you know, that was very rude what he did, blah, blah, blah. Go, this is your hint. You should look for, I'm forgetting what it was, but it was an anagram clue is what it was.
Yeah.
And so she runs off. And then the next day, Jodie Foster's character gets news that the guy that threw a specific bodily substance at her swallowed a towel or choked on his own tongue or something, but killed himself in his cell because Hannibal Lecter was whispering to him all night. Dude's already a schizophrenic. He was rude, so he signed a death warrant because he was rude. And Hannibal convinced him to kill himself as one of the voices of his schizophrenia, which is yikes, but also, consistent.
Yeah. Consistent. So he's a very consistent villain in the whole movie. Like, he's like this insane maniac who's a cannibal, but at the same time, it's just like he is very consistent in his methods and what he does.
Yep.
And he plays these psychological games with everyone who comes who he comes to contact with. It's like you have to pay very close attention to when he's on screen, what he's saying, because it comes up later oftentimes, or like it becomes into play much later on.
Yeah, compelling villains. I love the Hannibal Lecter ones.
This guy. Should I be concerned?
Should you be?
His origin story starts now.
Well, since we're discussing like almost like insane, crazy villains, how about we discuss a villain who's perhaps iconic for being crazy? What about the Joker from The Dark Knight?
Like, how did I know that he would come up in this podcast?
There's no way he was going to come up when talking about villains. What is that movie? It's like still like in the top 10 of like considered the best movies ever made. That was The Dark Knight, correct?
Yeah, The Dark Knight.
Yeah. I always get the names mixed up for no good reason other than I just forget. but what makes him compelling, as far as like surface level observations that I picked up on and that people seem to really latch onto is, he has a lot of control. Mm-hmm. He never has the means of having it, and yet he still has it. Mm-hmm. So he's resourceful, but also he's absolutely insane. Right. And for some reason, people eat that up. I would not know why. The other thing too is that he's one of those characters that if you don't really like, if you look at it at a surface level, his motives are very vague and you can't quite tell what it is. But it's not hard once you like watch it the first time to kind of get the idea of what he's doing. He's trying to be a menace. And he does it very well. He doesn't need henchmen. He can do it all himself.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it's like, because I mean, someone who's read the comics, like the Joker is like, his big thing is like, he loves to play with Batman, where it's like, you know, anything he can do to mess with Batman, like, and he's also one of the few villains out there who actually understands Batman on a fundamental level. So he knows how to screw with Batman on every possible level.
Yeah.
And like, because Batman is the detective. And since Joker is the agent of chaos, he's like, he just spreads chaos wherever he goes to put Batman on a wild goose chase for no good reason except to play with him. So,
and he's very honest in his what he says his motivations are to a degree that you almost don't believe that that's actually why he's doing it. But he's literally like, oh, the prize is to be the opposition to Batman. That is the prize. And that is why I'm here.
You're going to love this.
I don't want to kill you.
You complete me.
Yeah.
Now that we're on this track and, you know, more subtly doing that, we can just approach it the punch in the face way or the hammer to the face with Megamind.
I wasn't expecting that.
It's literally the same thing. It's the same thing. But like, instead of it being subtle, it's a hammer to the face.
Right. Yeah, it
it's
is.
It's not, I'm going to poke your nose and you're going to kind of get a little itchy. You're going to you're gonna learn what this is by
I guess you're right. Like, I didn't even think of Megamind, but he is exactly like the Joker. Like, he just wants to screw with Metro Man.
Yeah, exactly. And his whole thing is he feels incomplete without having a hero with him to oppose him. So then it loses his joy in it. He loses his joy in it. And I think that's hilarious. And he takes it so far that he has to create a new villain or a new hero.
A new hero,
for him to fight,
Picture a Joker plot like that. How hilarious would that be?
Oh, man.
Or I think Dark, there
is,
I guess.
I think there is a well,
is there?
I don't know. There's probably a comic. I know there's a comic where Batman was supposed to be dead and Joker got really depressed and like he didn't know what to do with himself because he thought Batman was dead.
Did you guys ever watch Watchmen?
I'm familiar with Watchmen. I've read the comic it's based on, but I have not watched this movie.
Okay. Maverick hasn't seen it.
I'm trying hard to hit everything, but you know.
Why haven't you watched every movie? In my 26 years of life, I've watched every movie, I promise.
I swear to goodness. You will sit me down for 2 weeks and we will watch everything, review it, and I won't have to come back on the pod for another 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So Watchmen is a Zack Snyder movie. It's considered an epic. Classic. It's controversial. The extended cut, the ultimate cut, is 3 hours and 35 minutes long.
Oh, man. Zack loves his long cuts.
He loves his long movies. That sounded like it was going to be bad for a moment there. But his villain the villain of Watchmen, I sometimes hesitate to use the term villain just because of how the whole plot sort of progresses. Mm-hmm. I'd say, Avalon, you've read the comic.
Mm-hmm.
He's understandable, but I don't find him as compelling as he should be.
I don't know. I had
a bit of a god
time,
complex
like,
with that one.
Yeah, he has a god complex, definitely. Like, he thinks he knows what's right. But it's not like that doesn't make him compelling. But honestly, Zack Snyder, very few of his movies does he have very compelling villains. It's just like across the board. Like, he's good at the action pieces, but it's just like when it comes to the villains, it's like, I don't relate to this. I don't understand this very well.
I think like where he excels are in like the not main villains, but the sort of like subcategory bosses.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I think like he doesn't need a lot to make a guy be like, oh, this guy's a bad guy and he's about to get his butt kicked in a really harsh way. Mm-hmm. And then he does in a way that's just kind of like, okay, all right, we'll just leave it at that. I think like the later his movies get, the more he falls off in that sense too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now we've been on that for a while, but for depth, like, cause we were looking at, motives, mission, mm-hmm. desires. Mm-hmm. I put depth for all of those.
Yeah.
Concluding thoughts on that section.
I mean, I don't have any concluding thoughts. I mean, we've kind of hashed out pretty well, I'd say.
I agree. Yeah.
I mean, maybe more could be said, but I mean, we've discussed these.
There's
discussed
so many things that
like,
can be said.
You could go into hours and hours discussing any of these traits, really. I mean, that's the other thing with these episodes, movies worth watching. We could probably do like
hours and hours.
For sure.
Yeah.
You could do like a day to discuss like one piece of each of these steps that you've written here for the villain. So the next one was weaknesses.
No, the next one I had was weaknesses. Essentially, like every villain, like a good compelling villain, isn't like an omniscient, like all powerful being. Like they have weaknesses. Like, and that doesn't necessarily mean like they're weak physically, like Mr. Potter is, but sometimes they're like they're like mentally, they've got a god complex, for example, or this or a, like for example, Kristoff from the Truman Show. Like he's the producer of the whole, like he's this average guy, but he has kind of this god complex thing going. And it's like, so when Truman is like kind of defying what he like trying to get out of the studio, it's like defying his will for the show. It more or less like it puts him in a collision course with the producer.
Yep.
Right.
So like in a way, the god complex is his weakness.
There's a movie from like the early 2000s called Evolution with David Duchovny. Mm-hmm. It's a comedy based on H.P. Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space, but it only takes kind of the basic concept of the book and builds a movie off of it. But long story short, meteor crash lands on Earth, and it has a lot of like bacteria on it that rapidly produce and evolve at a very high, like at a very high speed, like incredibly high speed. Within days, it has changed the environment of the cave that it made. And one of the things that this movie did that I always think of when we're discussing like weaknesses for the villain or the antagonist or whatever term we want to use, it's aliens. So they're, you know, motives are not as like easily read until it's just told to you, faced it like in your face in the movie. But its whole thing is it's supposed to expand and it's supposed to take over and it's supposed to basically consume the planet.
Mm.
And the way they discover what its weakness is and what the weakness actually turns out to be is one of the stupidest and funniest things that I've seen in a long time. Because I rewatched it recently. And it's like they're going over the chemical structure of the creature and it's like, okay, that's a good way to like work on like how to define those sorts of things. And then the idiot students that are helping the protagonists, the community college professors of the protagonists, there's like two idiot students in the movie that constantly are just like foils to the plot because they're so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Like they write a paper on cells, a very basic paper on like biological cells. And it says, cells are bad. My uncle lives in a cell. And that was the paper. But then they come in swinging going, oh wait, they're made of this? Wait, so that means that they're actually like they're not able to be in contact with this particular substance, and it's the active ingredient in Head and Shoulders shampoo.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, that's almost as bad as the water in Signs.
In Signs, yeah. Yes. Except I think it was significantly more compelling in Evolution because like there was actually a search for what the weakness is. The only reason you found out in Signs was because he actually hit the cup.
All I can say is I really pissed off one of my friends when I watched Signs because I started laughing at the climax.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not for everyone. Keep going, Avalon. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail there.
And sometimes, like, it doesn't even, like, they don't necessarily need an explicit weakness. They just have to be shown to be human enough. Like, I like, Back to the Future, Biff, the villain, like, the bully. Like, he's just an average high school student. Like, there are many ways you could defeat him, really, realistically. But he just has this control of the, like, he's got his gang, he's got his friends. It's clear that he's after Marty McFly's mom. It's just, like, the stage is set. Like this conflict, but like he's just an average guy, like so he's not like it's real. Like in our minds, it's realistic how he could be defeated 100 different ways. They just have to figure out like get the situation right.
And I think the important point here is not necessarily that they're obviously that characters like some characters are easily defeated if you find the right avenue. I think it's more interesting specifically on this point in regards to villains to look at the villains that are very, very powerful that look almost impossible to defeat, but have that one flaw. And that is the way to defeat them. And that is interesting because that becomes the locus of the locus that you focus on. So whether that's Sauron, exactly. Oh my goodness. The locus of focus.
Dude, you're a poet and you didn't know it.
I want to make, there's so many bad jokes that rhyme. So not going to go there, but what we will go to is Sauron from Lord of the Rings, my favorite. Let's go. Wow. He has one weakness and that weakness that he must exploit over 12 hours to defeat the enemy. What? That's crazy. No, but on a more serious note, the, what I actually think is interesting, I do think that's interesting, but I've already talked about Sauron, so it's not worth rehashing, is Thanos from the Guardians of the Galaxy. Well, actually from the Avengers, not Guardians of the Galaxy. But he's a character that in many ways is considered the ultimate bad guy in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And what's interesting about him is he in many ways seems near impossible to defeat, especially once he gets the Infinity Stones. And so the goal of defeating him is very out of reach, but you still see that this is a character that has weakness, and that's shown in other ways, specifically in regards to like what he values when he has to sacrifice Gamora in the Avengers Infinity War movie. That is where you see cracks in his armor, if you will, where he has to lose something that he values in order to achieve his end. And there's a sacrifice on the villain's part. And then you see that as well. Well, anyways, I could go on, but you were going to say something.
No, I just was going to say, like, in that regards, weakness makes him more relatable. Like, he makes him more understandable as a character to the audience. Where it's like, he's not just, oh, some big bad guy coming to defeat the heroes. It's like, he has depth. It gives him more, like, reason to understand him, like, what his, like who he is as a person. It gives an it adds a layer to him that makes him more interesting, more unique. And so he stands apart from the other guys in his mind.
I know we're addressing currently like the solo weakness, the one weakness that is the foil to the villain. You know, slowly you learn that kind of thing about the villain in these kinds of movies. I'm going to shift it a little bit here because oftentimes the strength of the villain is the weakness, exploits the weakness of the hero. So when you're looking at a movie like the subgenre home invasion horror movies like The Strangers, the elements of surprise, the number of people that are invading, the fact that they're prepared and they're ready to kill, and usually it's people that are not. The like The Strangers, for example, the first one is just it's a depressing movie. It's very grim. Three home invaders break into this couple's home. And basically, it's kind of a cat and mouse game until they both get captured. So we look at that, and I look at those villains. You don't; their motive is very kind of it's simple. Why are you doing this? And their only explanation they have is because you were home, which speaks to the more real life situation of random acts of violence that actually do happen all around the country, all around the world. that's still technically emotive, and it's that one's frightening in my eyes. So these villains tend to be like very hard to deal with, and they're very strong. And how's the protagonist going to fight this? Step in this next movie that I think is absolutely hilarious. Not a lot of people like it. I understand why, because it kind of subverts the expectations. But there's a movie called You're Next, which is another home invasion sort of horror movie, but instead of it being incompetent protagonists, the main protagonist was raised on a survivalist camp, and so while they're getting invaded, she's setting up like almost Home Alone like traps and taking advantage of like the fact that these aren't gods, these aren't demons, these aren't anything like that, these are just people. So if you put a board with nails under a window and they're not looking, they're going to step on a nail. It's going to hurt them. So it basically like takes the villain, and instead of it being like the element of surprise and it's the circumstances that give them the advantage, it's looking at the perspective of the fact that these villains are still flesh and blood people, and their weakness is that they die and they can get hurt.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing that, like, in movies where you're dealing with, like, for example, with Anton Chigurh, there's plenty of instances in the movie and in the book where he gets hurt.
Yeah,
and the part that makes him, especially at the end, but the part that makes him scarier about it is how he handles that. When he gets shot in the leg with, I think it was the submachine gun after the hotel shootout, he just goes and he patches himself up in the bathtub and does this. It's an incredibly painful sequence.
Yeah.
But he does it and like maybe groans a little bit. And that's it.
Yeah, no, it's like, yeah, like, he's Anton Chigurh, like he is a weak, like he's a human character. He is not like, he doesn't have like plot armor or like armor deflection. Like he doesn't, his skin doesn't stop bullets. But it's like, so he can get hurt.
He can get hurt.
Like whatever.
He can have any weakness the protagonist technically has, except for the fact that his mindset puts him in an advantage. Yes. And it's only his mindset that does it.
Yeah. And actually the fact that he's able to patch himself up in those painful sequences makes him more terrifying.
Yep.
Like gives us more that sense of dread. Cause like he's
unstoppable.
Well, it's like he's self-sufficient in some regards. So it's like, yeah, he's hurt, but he can fix himself. Just give him enough time. If the police or the hero doesn't find him before he fixes himself up, they're back to square one.
Yep.
And it's all over again. Round two.
Yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think weakness can go in many different directions too.
Yes.
We can address the single foil that Thanos would have. We can address like I'm trying to think of look at vampires.
Yes.
And sunlight.
Oh, yeah, vampires are a great example. Yeah.
They have one foil, and usually in a movie like I think Last Voyage of the Demeter has it, where they don't have the concept of a vampire in their heads. So they don't know that the sunlight's going to help them up until they learn that the sunlight's going to help them. Then they just realize that what their survival is, the weakness to take advantage of, is the fact that we just have to wait and survive until the sun rises.
No, and kind of going on the antithesis of what you were saying earlier, Patrick, about the idea of, you know, the weaknesses being the opposite of the strengths and vice versa. I think there's also a sense in which there can be compelling villains that are along the same veins, and maybe these are more so the examples I think of are only detective-ish or cat and mouse type movies, so I don't know if this applies to all genres, but there are times where it's both the hero and villain, or antagonist and protagonist, have the same powers or strengths. It's just that one is better than the other, and oftentimes it's the villain. And so that I think also is an interesting dynamic, because you have that with, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, or Kira and L from Death Note, where these characters are ones that are incredibly powerful, right? But their strength is just a little bit better than the other one. And that's what keeps the hero constantly out of grasp of what they need to achieve that goal. And that's what makes especially Moriarty such a formidable foe, is at the end of the day, Sherlock realizes he actually can't win, because Moriarty will destroy him, because he can play the game better.
And that's kind of like, I think we should go to a bit of a fundamental question. And there's multiple answers, I'd say, for this, but there's primarily two. that I think are important. And the question is, what is the function of a villain? What is the function of a good villain?
I mean, the good villain, like, I would say, like, a good villain, like, he is the foil of the hero or the protagonist, where it's like, he is the, like, if we're talking about themes and story, like, he represents the antithesis of the theme, whatever the hero or main protagonist embodies. He's, like, the exact opposite in some regards. Like, of all the compelling villains out there, like, they're the exact mirror opposite of the protagonist.
You're saying some of the best, or you're saying that all villains?
The best villains. I'm not talking about all villains, because obviously there are villains who are not that way, but...
I'm gonna rephrase it. I'm gonna rephrase what you're saying,
sure.
Because I think the best answer, at least in my opinion, my very perfect opinion, is that the function of a villain is to make the character learn how to defeat and how to grow and defeat a foil.
No, I
which addresses
probably,
it. It addresses what you say, but I'm specifically like referring to function. I think there's two functions of a villain. One is the most basic thing to say, they drive the plot.
Right.
And then the other thing is to present a foil for the protagonist so that the protagonist can grow. Mm-hmm. In those movies where the protagonist is so perfect, the villain is usually a nothing situation to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Right. And like, I think that's the other thing that maybe you're about to drive to, so I might be trying to steal your thunder, but and I'm not trying to, I just want to make sure this point isn't forgotten. But is that with the villains, you have, especially the villains we're talking about, right? We're not talking about natural disasters or the general self-conflict or whatever that's going on sometimes in movies. We're talking specifically about an antagonist who's trying to stop the hero. And in those situations, what you get a unique opportunity for is you get a unique opportunity for dialogue, right?
Yes.
Where these ideas and concepts can be brought back and forth against each other. And this big struggle about what is right and what is wrong in this situation can be really be delved in deep. And in the best situations, the villains make a compelling case for why the hero is wrong.
Yeah,
and I think that is what makes a very compelling storyline overall, because it makes a strong clash of ideals, and when the hero does win, it is completely justified after that long struggle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But sorry, go ahead. I don't know if that was where you were going or not, Patrick,
no,
but I wanted to make sure.
It fits the function. The whole function is like, sometimes it's by contrast to help the help the hero grow. Other times it's literally to kick the hero in the butt, Bane, and make them to go back and learn and readdress and reassess how to deal with it. Because I mean, movies have this great way of addressing the fact that there's no one size fits all solution to things. Sometimes your way of learning to deal with something is not the way to deal with it, and you have to readdress and look at it from a different perspective in order to address the situation properly and hopefully come out with a better outcome. We deal with that kind of thing in psychology all the time, because you can't address people as perfectly predictable, 100% this works with all people type solutions. That doesn't work. You always have to take it as a case-by-case basis, and the only way you're going to learn is by learning what doesn't work. And how do you learn what doesn't work? Well, oftentimes mistakes are made, and this usually isn't like something terribly large. It's not like the mistake you made is going to affect the life entirely of the person that you're talking with, but people learn best through mistakes, because it helps to narrow down. It helps to like correct your course when you're aiming the arrow, because you have one bullseye and infinite ways you can screw up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I think the function of the villain is also to help the protagonist hit that bullseye. At least narratively speaking, that's the function of a villain.
Right. I mean, obviously the villain is not cognitively thinking,
"Oh,
I'm trying to help them grow as a person," you know?
Something like that. I swear there's a movie like that. There probably is.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, that goes back to a whole motive, like, mission kind of thing, where it's like, they're not thinking how to make, like, they're just doing their own thing. The villains are like, I'm doing my own thing over here.
And you're Shutter Island. Technically, yes, Shutter Island is that.
I know, nice. I've heard of this movie, but I've not watched it.
Watch Shutter Island.
Yeah, it's a top tier.
I've ruined Shutter Island for myself. Great.
It's okay. We still got another point. We'll have plenty more.
Yep. Oh yeah. go.
There we go. Number four, right? Is that what we're on? Number four.
Yes. A sense of dread.
I mean, I guess we kind of feel, I feel like we've already been kind of talking about the sense of dread, but sure, we can just like talk about it more specifically.
I
but
love it's just a good like, sense of dread.
Yeah. Where it's like a villain who's just like when they act or like they subvert our expectations, it's like they instill in us like that feeling where it's like, oh shoot. Like what's going to happen now? Like, I feel like the best villains, they give us that where it's like, they subvert everything that we've expected. They change everything that's going on. I mean, and to go from our list, like Anton Chigurh does this a few times.
Yes.
Darth Vader does this several times in the original trilogy. For some reason, villains come. This movie villain wasn't on my list, but he comes to mind because it was something I just watched recently. I watched an anime recently called Made in Abyss, and they have this villain called Bondruid in the story arc, and he is like, I think he's one of the best villains I've seen in an anime in a while, in a story, just because he gave that sense of dread. Whereas, like, he was a fully fledged villain, but it just was like, there are scenes in there that just, like, took me completely off guard, where it just was like, oh, shoot, now what? Because, he was prepared. He knew exactly what to do, and he did things that, like, foiled the hero's ideas and their plots. And now it's just like they had to go back to square one, try again.
Yep. Right. I think another good example, and this one specifically for like horror people, was Vera from Fall of the House of Usher, where when she appears on scene, typically bad things happen. Very bad things happen. It's not established till like episode two. I won't get into any spoilers about that. Plus, I don't know if I'd recommend Fall of the House of Usher to you guys.
I almost considered watching that, but then I read more about it and I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to watch this.
Yeah. I'd say go for The Haunting of Hill House. You'll get an idea of the director's kind of like style for it. But Fall of the House of Usher is like a lot more into like making technically your protagonists, your main characters, despicable people. And the show is about them getting their comeuppance. Vera sort of being a representation of their comeuppance in episode two is where the first real situation happens where people get their comeuppance, and it gets referred to as a melt party.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's rough. It was very surprising, but every time after that, because they start off with quite a bang for when Vera shows up, every time after that Vera shows up, you're like, what's going to happen? I just watched 75 people melt into a puddle of acid. What's going to happen now?
Right. Yeah. And that's, I think that's important too, because and this might be just a general technique of building that dread, right? But you set that baseline. Right. When you have something occur, whether it's that first introduction or some surprise twist that occurs, if it's in the midway of a series or something like that.
Yeah.
But there's that activity that occurs that sets that baseline of how bad that person can be. And then after that, you have the anticipation that builds. And that's probably most clearly seen in like murder mystery movies, where you clearly see, oh, the villain who you don't know killed somebody and you're anticipating they're going to do it again. Right.
Pan's
and
so Labyrinth. Have you seen Pan's Labyrinth?
No, I've not. How do you have all of the references? I just don't know. Why can't we watch Frozen or something?
I'm going to be right back.
I need to watch Pan's Labyrinth. That's on my
watch. For those of you listening, Patrick left.
Anyways, I was just gonna say, not all villains though give a sense of dread. I feel like that's something. I mean, obviously they don't, but I think
this is why we don't watch Frozen.
You went hardcore. There we go.
Okay,
there we go.
I guess this is merchandise time or something. I don't know.
Like and subscribe. He should put on his Disney is Trash, a Lost Plot t-shirt.
You throw Frozen at me after I reference Pan's Labyrinth. How dare you? How dare you? Avalon, have you seen Pan's Labyrinth?
It's on my watch list, and I do want to watch it because I've heard so many good things about it.
It's going to take a bit because it is a Spanish film, so it is about subtitles. But very early in the movie, our antagonist is
confined. I'm no stranger to subtitles. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're bringing up anime. Our antagonist is given, and you kind of know who it's supposed to be, but you don't know like his the length. You don't know the depth of his being a bad guy up until he literally beats a dude's nose in with a beer bottle and kills him with that and then shoots his father in front of him.
Oh, man.
And that sets the tone. I remember watching this when it first came out with my parents and the brutality of it. We were all like, oh, so that's what he's like. And now you have that image in your head setting the tone for the rest of his interactions with everyone, knowing that this guy is capable of atrocious acts, and he's now in some way related to our protagonist, who is a young girl.
Yeah.
And you're terrified for her because now you see what he's capable of. She hasn't seen him do anything like that, which also adds to the dread is the perspective of the hero when they're helpless. So anyways, Disney's trash.
They only create good villains occasionally. Yeah. And usually then it's adapted work or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it's funny when you were describing him, you made me think of, oddly enough, villain that's sort of a villain Disney has made, but not really. It's like is adapted from Star Wars extra, the extended universe. I was thinking of Admiral Thrawn. And like the way he's developed in Star Wars Rebels, when I first watched it, like I just like thought he was gonna be the generic villain. But as the episodes progressed with him, it's like he had this like this these added layers that were just like adding onto each other. Like he was complex, he was interesting, and then there was these scenes where it's just like he had this pent up rage that you could see occasionally, and then like but then you quickly mask it. It was just like I apologize. Like he'd go back to this like formal attire. It's like oh, this is a guy who has like rage. This is a guy who has like. Like all these things pent up, but he's doing such a good job of control that just like you don't see it except in certain scenes.
The way I say it, this guy is one bad day away from going to prison.
So. Well, there's almost something more compelling sometimes with villains who are under control of their emotions than the ones who fly off the handle. Because then know when those villains do fly off the handle or when they do take action, it is either more extreme than the average person or it is intentional, which is oftentimes worse.
I'm going to throw a shot in the dark out there. I know it's probably going to not have been watched by at least one person here, Maverick. 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh, no, I got you.
He's seen that one. He's
perfect. Good.
Good movie.
Thank you for disappointing me.
Actually, that was an early one on this podcast.
Oh, that's right. The episode. Yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane, I think, is a good example of a good villain.
Yeah, he is very terrifying because you're stuck in the same area and proximity. Yeah, proximity is huge in that movie.
Claustrophobia and trust. Yeah,
exactly.
Dude, that movie, man. Oh. But yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane has a very compelling villain, in my opinion. I'm going through my movie list and I'm like, I don't want to put The Exorcist on there because I don't want to say that the demon from The Exorcist was compelling because that feels just awful to say that.
Right. Well, so, and when I was thinking about villains, I didn't really bring up the category of the extraterrestrial or like magical, super, just because I think Revenant. Sometimes... What's interesting about them, right? Because there is a sense in which mystery adds to these characters too, right? Exactly. And that's not a requirement for a great villain, but I think it can add a lot.
Oh, for sure.
And I think for that situation, the extraterrestrial or supernatural goes all the way to the extreme, where not only is there a mystery about these characters that you do not know, but there's a sense in which you can't know it.
Yes.
And that's just the state of nature. And it's dark and it's ominous and it's there and it's coming for you.
And one of my favorite examples of there is a medium in between that. Have you ever seen Sleepy Hollow with Johnny Depp?
No.
You're like, no, why would you think I'd see it?
At this point, why would you think I've seen any movies?
Yeah, continue to disappoint me, man. Come on. It's
and we're back to this.
I have lost all credibility in the span of an hour.
I hope this podcast... No, I'm not going to insult the podcast.
Everyone unsubscribes.
Everyone unsubscribes, and they're like, Patrick, why don't you make a podcast? I'm like, no, go back to his. It was a joke. It was a bit. But Sleepy Hollow is kind of the medium between that, because it's the story of the Headless Horseman, Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman.
Interesting.
The Headless Horseman is not only like kind of a supernatural being because it's a headless horseman, but in the movie Sleepy Hollow, it's from 1999, by the way, it still holds up in my opinion. It's kind of goofy too. It's not like he is just like a ghost where his motives are you have to discover them and then he'll go away. He still is a human character that takes some of the rules of the supernatural type villain while having some of the rules of the human type villain. He's corporeal, so he has a form. He has a body. He's just missing his head. He's like a puzzle piece. What does he want? He wants his head back. And then you learn his backstory and why he wants his head, because he was wronged and he was killed because I think he came back from war or something like that, and people looked at him as a monster and they started like hunting him to kill him. And so he swore an oath of vengeance. And his whole thing is like, if you have his head, you can control him, but he doesn't know that you have his head.
Interesting.
But yeah, he follows that sort of rule. He eventually becomes human again and still with more human, but less supernatural, but still some of that in there. But I always put him as like kind of the in-between stage of that versus like something like The Exorcist, where it is an entirely supernatural threat, or any movie where the ghost is the primary plot.
Right. And so to be clear, right, there's often times where they have supernatural elements in a story. And this is getting a little more generic, but just as a general rule, there can be rules in a universe that they set in place that they then explain very completely. And that can be helpful for the sake of putting limitations, especially on the protagonist.
Every Brandon Sanderson novel, they can't just do
whatever they want. Yeah, exactly.
It's like supernatural abilities. It's magic. It's part of the magic system. We'll look at like Lord of the Rings. We can look at Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. All of those where it's like by technicalities, it's a supernatural type thing. But it's and part of the lore of the world, and so it builds more of a generalized function as opposed to the whole point of a ghost story is that it doesn't happen that often, and it's not like you're going to be immediately like, all right, let's get those holy waters. Let's get the holy water guns.
Exactly. Yeah. You're not blessing the Catholic mass and then taking it out to hunt.
Yeah.
You know, this is it's specifically mysterious and unknown, and because it's the villain, it's okay to have it not have those bounds. It's limitless for the sake of being a terror,
and that's its
function. But yeah, I think that explanation of rules of the universe kind of goes in line with that middle ground that you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing I'd like to end like that section with, just about Dredd in particular, I just want to clarify that obviously not all villains give a sense of dread, obviously.
Yeah. Sure.
But what we're talking about when we say sense of dread, because people are going to point out villains like, oh, not like their favorite villains don't give a sense of dread. Like, I'm talking about the great, like the classic villains, like great villains who we like, everyone thinks of as like, oh, this is an excellent villain. Like, they usually give a sense of dread, I'd say. Not like, obviously there are some villains that are exceptions, but for the most part, they give this like we have this innate fear of them. Like, this is why
there's a reason they're a villain, and there's a reason the hero has to fear them. Leonardo DiCaprio's character from Django Unchained. He kind of like is a dreadful person to be around, and like you worry what he's going to do based off of how unhinged he is.
I just wanted to make that clear, just as like, I think what separates great villains from the regular villains is that sense of dread. Like, we fear them. It's why we don't root for them. We root for the protagonist instead, whether they be anti-hero or hero or whoever they are. Generally, that's what makes them different.
Well, that's the pod. We hope you all enjoyed. We will be back. Yes, a roundtable discussion.
Is next episode the Disney episode where we get to talk all things Disney?
Yes, we're going through the princess series.
Oh,
No, not seriously. But if you want us to review that, leave a comment down below in the review. Oh my goodness. We'll be back next week. See everyone then.
We'll see you then.